and yes, that music can only mean one thing. It is time for the Enduro World Series podcast. We managed to get 2020 in the books against all odds, and now we are getting excited as we look ahead to what promises to be a mouth-watering 2021. More racing, more teams than we've ever fielded before. My name is Rick McLaughlin, and just before we hit record on what was actually going to be a different subject title, actually, I received an email from Nukeproof Bikes announcing the then heavily embargoed arrival of a rather special new bike. And so I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk not only about that bike, but also use it as a bit of a springboard, or maybe just excuse is a better word, to talk about EWS race bikes, where they've been and what the future holds for them. Joining me is a man who's thrown a leg over his fair share of fast machinery in the past. It is EWS Sports Coordinator and bike racer extraordinaire, Rory Cunningham. Rory, how has your week been and what have you been chipping away at on Planet EWS?
Good to speak to you, Rick. Yeah, it's been an interesting week here. We've had a lot of snow. It feels very wintry, so saddling up on the keyboard more than the bike, unfortunately. But we've got an amazing season planned for 2021. So a lot of prep goes into it behind the scenes that I maybe didn't appreciate as a racer, but it's looking good. We're all moving in the right direction, and excited for some racing this summer.
Now, hopefully at some stage in the future, we'll be able to make these chats video-based just so that people can see your haircut at the minute, because it's frankly fantastic. A finer head of hair lockdown has yet to produce. Now, let's talk about the Nukeproof Giga, a brand new bike from Chain Reaction Cycles' own brand. I actually thought when I read the name in my inbox that it was going to be the much-rumoured e-bike finally breaking cover, but it isn't. We'll have to wait if that is actually going to be a thing. It is their new, what they're calling, I think, Super Enduro bike. Now, before we dive into the bike itself too much, Super Enduro, this is a term that seems to currently being bandied around the bike industry quite a lot behind the scenes. The bike industry, as we both know, loves a catchy genre title, something new to market. And I think that this one breaks down simply into being a longer travel enduro race bike. In the case of the Giga, we're talking a whopping 180mm of suspension travel for the 27.5-inch wheel version. I think that drops to 170 for the 29. What do you think of this march towards longer travel then, Rory? Good thing, bad thing?
Well, firstly, I've seen the bike in person.
Where? Where have you seen it?
Well, Nigel Page, the Chain Reaction Cycles team manager, and Nukeproof, I guess, bike developer, maybe, is what you would refer to him as. He's seen the light and moved to Scotland. So locally, he's been out and about on the trails, and it's some machine. I think, like you said, you look at the numbers, 180mm of travel, with a 650B or 27.5 back wheel, a 63.5-degree head angle. I mean, they're getting close to downhill numbers. And
that pretty much is downhill numbers from a couple of years ago, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously with more travel, but frame numbers wise, you're in the ballpark, aren't you?
Go back 10 years ago and there wasn't many downhill bikes with a 63.5-degree head angle. But I think it's warranted, you know. Trail bikes or enduro bikes are becoming so capable. Riders are going so much faster, trails are becoming tougher, technology needs to move with the development of the racing, and we're seeing that. There's not really a weight game anymore. People aren't thinking, oh, maybe go for a 140, 150mm travel bike or a faster rolling tire on the back or a lighter casing. People are just going, if it's got more travel, if it's stronger, if I can give it more abuse, I'll run it. And I think that's what we're seeing with Nukeproof, a company that's at the forefront of this sort of thing. They're not afraid to try something different and push kind of geometry and sizing and travel in the market that maybe is slightly above or slightly at the more extreme end. You know, we've seen that with the first Mega they did. I remember when that got rolled out probably 10 years ago. Now it was you know, slacker and more travel and longer wheelbase.
Still a good looking bike, that Mega as well. It's still a nice looking bike. I also really enjoy the fact that here's me with my journalist hat on, thinking I've got this big exclusive look at a bike that's just sitting in my inbox, and you've actually seen the thing in the metal as well. It's sort of depressing.
I have a full review and in a Gauss accent as well. So,
well, this is apparently Pagey.
It's been great.
Apparently, Pagey, who is, if you're new to EWS, he is the Chain Reaction Cycles team manager, very successful racer in his own right, still races at the top end of the Masters field as well. Apparently, from what I've been told by Nukeproof, they give him, he's been pushing for it for a while. They gave him a bike to test, and then they couldn't get the test mule back off him again. He liked it that much, and that was kind of what greenlit the project. So let's talk about some of those numbers. So yeah, 180 millimeters of suspension travel with a small 27.5-inch wheel in the back of it, 170 for the 29, 63.5-degree head angle, as you said, a wheelbase on a size large, 1282 mil. That's getting near 1300 millimeters of like wheelbase. Standover height, you could probably measure that in double-decker buses. 120mm of top tube for the size large. That's a massive bike, isn't it? You're talking serious numbers.
It is, and it's good to see the medium and the large actually reflecting the sizes that are meant to suit. And you see quite a lot of brands choosing quite short bikes for the medium and large. And, you know, here we've got a 460mm reach for the medium and a 480 for the large. And that goes right up to as a double XL at 520. So, good luck turning that thing. But you know, it's good to see those numbers reflecting, and people are wanting more space in the reach department and longer wheelbases, and you know the stability that provides. And it's good to see them pushing those numbers out even further.
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, you say like, you know, good luck turning it, but I mean, I'm not like, you know, I'm not like some kind of like 8 foot tall gangly freak, but at the same time, I'm gangly actually. I'll give you gangly, yeah. At 6'1",
but you got the rest spot on.
I'm 6'1", and 3 years ago I was riding a double XL. Like, I was always looking for extra large bikes, and I always sort of wondered that, you know, what are people who are over 6'1" doing, because it felt like I could never get a bike long enough. And now I'm sort of sliding back to just being on the large again. So maybe it's just sizes getting caught up to speed. I don't know. It's an interesting one. It's definitely one of the things that is clear from what I'm hearing from Nukeproof is that it's kind of the rest of the bike catching up with a new breed of 38 mil stanchioned fork. That are on the market now. You've got Fox's 38, you've got the RockShox Zeb, and it's their descent downhill bike really sort of being molded into an enduro race bike. So I think that's an interesting it's an interesting prospect really, and they're very much saying that it's a reaction to Enduro World Series stages getting steeper, rougher, faster. If you had to take the longer travel option, is there a round that stands out for you that you might want that?
I mean, if we look at the calendar this year for the EWS, we've got the first doubleheader in Val d'Fassa. Big, fast, open mountain.
That's a good show.
Going to be some good lift access stages, be high speed. So straight away, if you can get an extra 20 mil of travel out the back and a 180 fork up front, happy days. From there, you know, we move on to the Tweel. I mean, that place is renowned for having steep, fast, rough stages. And then by that point, you know, it's your four rounds in, your four races in. So, yeah, I think it is a reflection of what we're seeing at races. I think tracks are developing with bikes. Racers are getting faster, which is proving quite tricky as far as a racing standpoint goes, because the faster they go and the quicker they descend, the longer the days have to be. So
yeah.
We have a rule in EWS that the minimum race time is 20 minutes, which when stages are longer and flatter and more undulating is quite easy to manage. When stages are faster and more direct and steeper and riders are going really damn fast, 20 minutes of racing quite often equates to over 2,000 metres descent. And what we then see is that we're running out of time, we're running out of mountains. So, yeah, I think it's a reflection of the direction that we're going in. It puts pressure on us to ensure that we develop with the technology and with the pace of the riders. And I think this year we're going to see some of the most exciting racing we have. So, yeah, I think the sport and the technology is moving forward together in unison. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Well, this is it, isn't it? I mean, we've talked a lot in the past about, you know, racing bettering the breed. And, you know, you're not talking that long ago, maybe 4 or 5 seasons ago, that there was still the odd, like, double front chainring and front mech knocking about. If you go all the way back to the start of the Enduro World Series, they really were just modified trail bikes, weren't they? And now you're starting to see what really looked like sort of, well, this nuke proof is case in point, isn't it? It's a downhill sort of a downhill take with a slightly steeper seat angle that you can pedal all day. How, like, you know, for these pros these days, how big a factor do you think is the weight of these bikes, or is it the case of you're sitting in a better place to climb all day, so it's not as big a deal? How much of a penalty does weight pay?
I think with the way bikes are developing, you know, we're seeing more carbon frames, carbon wheels. They're losing weight in certain areas, and other areas such as tires, I don't really see how they go. You know, if you think like a set of, you know, full downhill casing tires is kind of about 1.1, 1.2 kilos. That's without inserts or sealant. I don't see how you really lose weight off of them. The riders will be on either a replica race bike or the equivalent of a race bike for most of the off season, and spending long hours on the trails, so they'll know what it takes to climb at that pace. But yeah, we're not seeing riders sacrificing speed on stages to help them on the liaisons. If anything, it's quite the opposite. They're gearing their bikes 100% towards descending, and things like a seat tube angle, which doesn't really affect you when you're riding down, but can help you or accommodate an easier position when climbing, are ways that manufacturers and brands are suiting bikes to climb better without hindering the performance of descending. If that was to go another way, for example, if you were to see somebody have a faster rolling or lighter rear tire, that would be lighter for the transitions or the liaisons, but also roll faster, but it was slower on the way down. Very, very few riders are choosing that option, and I think that's kind of, yeah, that's a reflection of what stages and are these days, what the courses are like, but also the speed they're having to ride to be at the cutting edge of it. So yeah, I think we're only seeing them gearing their equipment towards descending. And in any way they can accommodate it to make it easier, they can.
Well, you're the man to talk to. Can you clarify just for me, we've got coming up in 2021, we've got the new Pro Stage format, which is going to see a single stage put in front of hopefully as many people as we can, depending on COVID and all that sort of stuff. Would there be an option to run a heavy hitting, longer travel bike for that stage? That, you know, could you change the frame? Or the frames are marked, aren't they? You'd incur a penalty for that.
We're going to maintain the wheel marking stickers, so a wheel marking sticker on each wheel or each rib, fork, which goes on the crown, and then we have two frame stickers, so one for the front triangle and one for the swing arm. We'll maintain that. I think it keeps things quite fair between the amateur and the pro field. You can't just go changing wheels or changing parts and destroy them 2 stages at a time. But it will be interesting. I'm really looking forward to seeing how the pro stage unfolds, because it's going to be a shorter, more kind of high-speed, intense stage. There's going to be points available for the top five positions. And it will factor into the kind of reseeding of race day as well. So it's going to be an exciting start to the racing.
It's going to be fascinating, isn't it? Because we've seen it in the past where, you know, that the second day of racing, it's predicted very, very bad weather at a certain time. So it may suit you to get off earlier in the day or to sandbag and wait for the weather to have passed. And we can see all kinds of shakeups.
So we're going to reseed the, I think it's only maybe the top 20 or the top 10 riders. So the top 30, the best ranked riders will come down at the end, regardless of where they seed.
Ah, okay.
So we keep racing fair in that way. There's not going to be any mind games or tactical weather maneuvers. Like, they'll be down within kind of half an hour of all of them. So,
right. Let's get back to the Giga. Now, this, it does have one feature that I personally, it appeals to me in a big way. And I say this as an avid bike geek whose nerdery far, far surpasses my actual talent on a bike. But it does have a lever that you can flick to allow it to switch to a setting with more progression. What that actually translates to, nuke proof claim, is a whopping 3.5% more progression on the fly. So their sort of take on it is that if a stage is going to be wetter than you think and you want to use a bit more travel and get the back wheel into things and active a bit earlier in the stroke, you can switch that and bask in that 3.5%. Now, I am a man who will sit in an airport car park for 15 minutes messing about with the drive modes in a Citroen Cactus rental car before I head out to find where I'm going. As a racer, does that sort of thing actually bring any benefits, or am I just being a nibbler?
I think you've just admitted to the millions of listeners that you're a grade A nibbler.
I like that you think there's millions of people listening to this. That's promising anyway.
No, it's a nibbler's listening to this, so they love it. But
love the nibble.
It's difficult. I think it'll only be really noticeable to the best riders. But if you are talking like 1 or 2%, if you look at times, if you look at an overall race and the winning time is say 22 minutes and the difference between first and second, it's sometimes, you know, 3-4 seconds, which if you look at a percentage is not point.
Two tenths of North Star, but like Richie Rude, Sam Hill, two tenths of a second, that is worth a nibble.
My math, I'm going to pull me through there and tell you what percentage that is, but it's not very much. Look, I think it's cool. I really like to see companies pushing this sort of stuff. We've seen flip chips and whatever on other bikes before, but actually just having a little lever you can flick is really, really cool. It's interesting that we're seeing an enduro bike. If we look at the kind of the geometry and the leverage curve and how progressive it's not really a leverage curve that lends itself to pedaling efficiency, shall we say. And I think that is again a kind of a good move by them. That's why we have lockout on our shocks or certainly like a climb mode where we can just flick it in and it just sits on a platform. But it's really good to see them building the leverage and the way the bike and the way the suspension works around descend and not about having a platform and a bike that pedals well. So power to them.
Well, this is it. Yeah, I mean, it has got what you could probably refer to as a lot of nuke-proof's tried and tested formula of what the Mega's always done. That's a rearward axle path, I think, is about as much as 50 mil, and anti-squat that really drops off when you get into the steep stuff. So I think if you were a Mega owner, I'd say you would get on a Giga and probably find yourself in bigger but quite familiar territory. Other cool things it has then, space for a bottle cage. Nuke Proofs now have room for a bottle cage, which is, do you know what? Like, I'm gonna go out and say it, that I can't imagine ever owning a bike again without a bottle cage.
I'm 100% with you there. I would never go out and wait to buy a bike that didn't have a bottle cage. It just does not make sense.
No, I'm not into it.
If someone comes up with a better solution than a bike bottle, my bike will always have a bottle cage.
Love a bottle cage. This one actually has two sets of mounts. Second set are underneath the top tube. I'm wondering if that's for securing tubes and a tool or stuff like that. There's a few different options you can use that for, I guess. So that's pretty good. 148 mark middle back end. Of course it does. It's got a pretty trick mudguard, actually. That's something that I've often wondered about. You see a lot of bikes. Remember in Colombia, Manizales, on the second stage, that stage that Sam pumped so much time into everyone on, Sam Hill. The bottom of the stage, it was really, really thick, sort of like clingy clay sort of mud, and the amount of like
I can tell you that firsthand because I was rolling around in it.
Well, like your bike fills from the back, doesn't it? Like, so a mud guard for me, that makes a load of sense. What else?
It keeps all that about the linkage of the bike as well. Like if you look where it's positioned, it's going to keep the stanchion on the shock and all that kind of linkage as clear as it can. So,
Is that the worst mud you raced in at an EWS? It's certainly some of the worst I can remember.
Off the top of my head, yeah, I remember there was a climb on one stage. It was a jog.
Taking the bike for a walk.
Yeah, it was. I think it was about, should have been about 20 seconds from the start of the first stage with the street race, and then with the first stage the following day. And it should have been about 20 seconds from the start, and it was about 2.5 minutes from the start because it took that long to get there.
You did well at that street race, didn't you? What, were you fourth or something?
Fifth, yeah.
Fifth? I'll give you one more place there than you actually got.
Well, I'll take it.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was a cool one,
man. You were going down there like Casey Stoner with a knee down. Right. Do you think... Well, let's flip the question around the other way. Is there a case for less travel? Because we're seeing some taller guys, the likes of Jack Moyer, going for slightly smaller frame sizes in 2020, certainly. Do you think there are some venues where maybe a 140mm, 150mm bike might be more applicable? Or is it always a case of just stick to one bike, longer travel, get used to it?
I don't think it's black and white. I think rider preference comes down to it. Jack's one of the guys, I guess, for a tall, lean guy, he rides quite a small bike. Whereas we see other riders riding relatively large bikes for the size of them. Say someone like Jesse Melamed or, and then you get guys like Sam who are probably bang in the middle. I think it does come down to preference. A lot of it may come down, I can certainly see it with the smaller, lighter riders, they'll maybe go towards a kind of lighter option bike. I think if you have a full 29er race bike with kind of 170, 180 mil rear travel, and you've got short legs like me, then suddenly it does become difficult to kind of get off the back and move your weight around as easy. I think we're seeing a lot of people adopting the mullet setup to counter that.
Would you go mullet if you were still racing? Would you go mullet?
Yeah, 100%. I haven't tried it. I was a bit skeptical at first. I guess I was very, in 2018, 19 was very, well, 18 it wasn't even a thing. 2019 I was very comfy with the setup I had. And having tried it recently, it's, you can see why it's a positive change. Not just for kind of shorter riders, but, you know, losing a bit of height or a little bit of size at the back wheel, or if you have a 650D bike and you put a 29er wheel and fork on the front, it neutralizes the geometry of the trail. Like we're designing bikes, so we're riding bikes, so they're as good as they could be going down. If you mullet a bike and you drop the back and raise the front, instantly what you do is you neutralize the geometry to be more suited to the terrain you're riding on. So if you look at it like that, it puts more weight through your feet, It raises the front so there's not much pressure through your hands. I mean, it makes sense. And then with the extra space at the back, and you get your weight around a bit more. And if you look at it like that, it does make sense. But it's not going to be for everybody. I think taller riders, it maybe won't affect them as much. We've certainly seen a lot of riders just continue with the 29er front and rear. It's becoming increasingly popular, and we're now seeing brands having it on bikes as in retail. You know, they're coming off the shelf as a mullet setup.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there hasn't been the sort of backlash that we've seen with different wheel sizes and stuff before. Where 29s got big, and like Loic Bruni came out and said they should be banned and stuff, and people got quite angry about them. And the mullet thing just seems to have arrived. Everyone's gone, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's not really anything. It's not really anything that wasn't there before. It's just a combination change, I guess. But I mean, you know, as soon as people went, you know, it wasn't even that long ago, like 7 years ago, 26-inch wheels for life. Like, when was the last time you saw a 26-inch wheel bike? They don't even know. Apart from the, like, slope style, but, I think racers can sometimes be quite critical of technology advancements and be a bit defensive, certainly if they're very comfortable on what they're running. You know, like famously said he would never ride a 29er, and then, you know, stuck a 29er wheel on the front, and then, you know, in 2019, just absolutely, I mean, World Cup title and World Championship title, and then suddenly it was like the mullet setup was legit. It was, that was it. It works. So
it's, also, I think, just bringing it back to the Giga for a second as well, it's, I don't know, I'm, you know me, I'm sort of an old-fashioned sentimentalist, and I kind of feel that if this is their new EWS race bike, and it's not the end of the line for the Mega for a second, I think the Mega will always be with us, but the Nukeproof Mega, if you look at it in terms of what it's won over the years, I mean, there's three bikes really. There's the Yeti SB series, and that's arguably not one individual bike. Common Sal's Meta and the Nukeproof Mega that really have done the bulk of the winning. You know, there's a couple of others in there as well. But I actually asked Rob Sherritt from Nukeproof if this was going to be their new sort of standalone race bike, and I think the key question everyone wants to know is, will Sam Hill be racing it? And he came back with quite a level answer, saying that Sam will use it at the EWS, and he'll always basically use the fastest bike that he thinks he has an option to run. He used a good example of this sort of quite relaxed approach to what the riders are riding with. Elliot Heap getting a medal at the Four Cross World Champs on his Nukeproof Mega. Nukeproof don't seem to get hung up on, you know, what the guys are riding, and I think they're going to give them the freedom to choose. That Mega, though, of Elliot's at the Four Cross Worlds was interesting, because I actually saw it in the SRAM pit and assumed that it would be the frame, you know, with a completely altered drivetrain fork, and it was... No, it was basically the same bike I'd seen the week before in Enduro World Series with the seat slammed. He still had a dropper in it, I think, as well.
Oh,
so fair play to Elliot.
He's got some power that way, like.
Yeah, he has got some definite power. Again, a word that neither of us can say. So we should talk about...
As a final kind of comment on the Giga, I think Nukeproof, with that bike, are probably one of the few brands that have two legitimate race bikes.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
If you look at a lot of other brands, and you know, they have that enduro bike, or what they say is that, you know, what their enduro racers ride, which is a kind of 160 mil travel bike. Not many of them are pushing out a 180 mil travel bike on top of that. So I think they're in a pretty unique position, as they've got a long travel bike. If the stages are, you know, really, really kind of steep, fast, and they want, you know, as much travel as possible, they can go with a Giga. And then if you're looking at something, I guess maybe like what Finale was last year, was some kind of flatter, more undulating stages, and something where you want some a bit less travel, a bit more of a platform, lighter, than you can go with Mega. So you know, they're in a really good position, and a unique position at that.
Yeah, I mean, you can't obviously judge a bike on paper based on its numbers, although a lot of people try to. But the idea of Sam Hill returning to action on something with that much travel and that slack would be quite a menacing prospect, I guess, for a lot of EWS pros. Now, we are going to record a separate episode of this, looking at the silly season and the musical chairs and stuff that is sort of unfolding as we speak. In fact, whenever we press stop on the record button here, I'm sure once we go online, there'll probably be two or three more people announcing where they're going to be riding next year. But whilst we've just mentioned Sam Hill, back on Nuke Proof for another 3 years, no great surprise there.
No, look, I think he's happy there. He's got a really, really close-knit little team. Him and Nigel get on really, really well. He's got JC with him. He obviously has Elliot Heap as a teammate. His kind of his association with Nuke Proof's been, it must be seven years now. It's been a long time.
Seven or eight, yeah. I think this is number eight.
Yeah, and they've got the, you know, they've got all the signature parts, and it makes sense. I mean, it's good to see him sign a new deal, and we're going to see him in the EWS for another 3 years. So, no, that's awesome. And he certainly had people going with his post. Went fishing and cast the bait out, and a lot of people bit. But I think it was only one option, and he was gonna stay. So
yeah, I think there's a quite a mischievous part of Sam that you occasionally see at the EWS. There's a sort of a wry smile and a look, and I think he'll have known full well how that the text of that Instagram post, just if you haven't seen it online, go onto Sam's Instagram, scroll back a few posts, and there's one thanking Nuke Proof for all the years together, and the sort of thing that riders tend to put out the day before they announce who they'll be riding for in 2021. And if Rob and the rest of Nuke Proof knew about it, I'm sure it still sent like a shiver of like, oh my god, what's happening down their spines. But yeah, I mean, getting back to the racing, it's a tantalising prospect, 2021. You've got, you know, Sam back. We didn't see him in 2020. Interesting to see what that difference will make. I mean, he's been racing full-time for so long. One of the last big breaks he probably took was before he won his last downhill world champs, wasn't it? Was that 2010 or something? There's people probably screaming at their phones now.
World Championships in 2010. I think it was
St. Anne, wasn't it?
It was a forced layoff. I'm pretty sure that was the year he had a huge crash at Fort William below the Deer Gate, and there was a famous photo of like a bike with two exploded wheels being carried off the hill, and he came back, had a shoulder repair, came back and won World Championship.
Yeah, that's it. But yeah, he hasn't missed a lot of racing in the last 15 years or so. So I don't know.
It could do him the world of good.
It could.
It'll be over 18 months. He'll have been kind of, by the time we get racing in July, it'll be over 18 months. He'll have been at home with the family, and you never know. It might be what he needs to recharge the batteries and find that hunger, and you know, come out and be looking for a fourth world title. So I don't think Sam's the kind of rider who would line up if he didn't think he could win. I don't think he's going to turn up to make up the numbers. I know. I think he'll be as big a threat in 2021 as he's been the last 3-4 years. And we're really excited to see him back.
Right, I'm gonna throw something out there that I was gonna say you're either gonna agree or disagree with, but knowing you'll probably disagree wholeheartedly, but I don't think Sam would have had an answer for Jesse Melamed in 2020. I think Jesse was that form rider that just had the speed. Do you agree with that statement?
As a bold statement. I'm going to agree and disagree. I think at finale, at the final round, we saw a level of riding from Jesse that would have been difficult to be matched by anybody. He won the first stage by a mile, won the next two, and then just turned it back a few clicks, cruised through the last one. He's still sixth or seventh and won very convincingly.
Although I haven't made that statement, I'm now rethinking it because of the weather in Zermatt. And if
so, that's my next point, is the weather in Zermatt. Sam has a reputation for being the king of the mud and the king of the wet. Some of his performances over the years have been pretty jaw dropping in the worst conditions. So there's nothing to suggest that he wouldn't have done something similar. And Pietro would have been a really, really interesting one because it was dry and wet. We had the first two stages pretty much bone dry. Then we got a big kind of storm rolled in as the top 30 riders were on the Queen stage. And then suddenly the afternoon was much slicker, more rutted. Would that suit him? I mean, as the only guy really the male rider, I think Morgan Shaw rides flats as well, but the only male rider who's really at the front of the field on flat pedals, the conditions where you can just get a foot off and slide around and not lose a huge amount of time trying to get clipped back in and things, you feel they would suit him. I guess there's only one way we'll find out.
This is it. There's only one way, and hopefully, we're going to have the rest of the pro men back to full strength as well. We should talk a wee bit about a rider you've just mentioned as well, Morgan Shaw. Massive season for her in 2020. Do you think we're going to see more of her in 2021?
Yeah, I think we will see more of her. I think the win for her in finale was pretty big. I know certainly myself and we didn't predict it. I thought the stages may have been a bit flat and a bit peddly for her, but no, she won convincingly. And you've got to put her as she's a race winner now. She's in that top three, four or five riders who can win a race. And is she going to be a title contender? But the speed's there. It's just the consistency, really. And we might see her and Isabel battling the title.
Right. Well, we've currently successfully wandered off topic, talking about riders instead of bikes. But that's just it's just kind of what's happened. To finish, then, I'm your team manager. I'm telling you, you can have a 180mm bike or a 150mm bike to race this season on all courses. What are you taking?
Well, I'm in charge of the courses, so whatever one's the best colour, and then all the courses suit the bike.
Yeah, it's not a bad answer, is it? If you're back in your pump, would you have gone for the longer travel option? And you can't change; you've got to stick with.
So the last time I was racing, I was on a 150mm bike, and I always wanted more. I always wanted longer, slacker, more travel. I ended up going against engineers' suggestions and putting
a
fork on it because they deemed it might be too much leverage for the head tube.
But do you think that's because you're an ex-downhiller? Do you think that's because you are making that bike feel more like what a race bike feels like in your head?
Yes and no. I think I don't feel like I ever had or ever have the most aggressive riding style. I actually feel I'm quite smooth. The amount of components I go through might say otherwise, but
scrap heap challenge.
I like to think it's pretty composed. But I've always felt quite in touch with what I want. I've always been able to say the direction I feel I need to go in bike-wise, and that was certainly me putting the biggest fork I could on it to try and offset the fact that I couldn't get more rear wheel travel, because then if the rear is only going to be 150mm, then I can make it effectively longer, slacker, get myself in a better position geometry wise by having a bigger fork. So that's kind of what I did. But I think it'll be interesting to see how many riders would choose effectively a Giga style bike, the 180mm travel bike versus say a 150, 160. But for me, I think I'd be going the bigger travel bike and making it count on the fast and rough sections.
What is there a difference? Would you rather have a bike that's front end work better or back end work better? Is there a difference?
I think the rear of a bike is a lot more down to geometry, the shock, whatever brand of shock you use definitely has an effect, and the tune on that definitely has an effect. But I feel you can put a good shock on a bad bike and it'll still be a bad bike. Whereas if it works, if you've got a good leverage ratio and a good rate of progression, and you don't need the world's best shock to make it work. Conversely, you can put a really bad shock on a good bike and it'll make it a bad bike. I've had that done as well. But I think there's effectively the fork is the front and the whole frame is the rear. And the way you should ride is more weight should be through your feet than through your hands. Your feet take the weight of your hips, your legs, most of your torso, and then it's kind of like it's only really your head and shoulders and arms that are above your handlebars. So there's a lot more weight on the rear wheel. So if you were wanting to perform best, that's what I would choose. Conversely, some people would say, you want a more predictable front end than a rear end. But I feel you can get away with a poorly performing fork or front end by steering with the rear. So in an ideal world, you'd have both. I'd rather a good bike with a bad fork than
It's interesting you should mention forks, actually. 2020, we saw the arrival of the big 38mm, super burly enduro race forks. And then we saw a couple of big names sort of creep away from them again and go back to the slightly slenderer 36 models. What's that to do with? Is that just front-end stiffness? Is that vibration coming through them because they're not moving, energy transfer? What's that about?
I think it could be a number of things. Stiffness is one, obviously. The bigger the stanchions and the bigger diameter, the stiffer it's going to be. The other, as a racer and as someone who's been in that position, if you get given a new product and you have 2 weeks before the first race of the year, then chances are that 2 weeks isn't enough to get comfortable or to really learn it, or to, especially with the way things were, there wasn't exactly many SRAM camps during the summer.
No, that's true. Time on product was limited, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of riders will just have, they might have had it stuck on their bike and then just not had enough time practicing, testing, going back and forward to really feel comfortable, and they would have chosen the older model, which would have been the Lyric, I think, over the
36.
But it's up to preference. I mean, we saw some riders adopting it and say it wouldn't change it, it's the best thing they've ever ridden. We did hear other riders say they thought it was a little bit stiff. Interestingly, Nico Williams wasn't running it on his e-bike, I don't believe.
That's interesting on a bike that weighs that much as well, I guess.
Mm.
I not for one second putting myself in the same bracket as Nico Vuglio, but my experience on the bigger fork was that you do need a bit of speed behind it to just bring it to life a bit. And on a flatter trail with some glossy roots, you don't necessarily have that front end feel that you're maybe used to. I don't know, what's your take on them?
I've not ridden them, mate, so I wouldn't know. But
I got you on one thing anyway, at least.
I was stuck on that post-speckle thing.
Right, let's go on then.
Worked from 1995 and was fine.
We've had a chat about some bikes, well, a bike and a couple of other things around it. Now, that's the next time out, let's talk about some humans. We sort of talked a little bit about Sam Morgan there, but I think we really need to schedule another one of these and talk about silly season, maybe quite quickly, so we can make some of our famously inaccurate predictions. Good to keep that trend rolling from 2020, and talk about who's going to be riding what. Yeah, as I say, news of that is coming in thick and fast. Ruairi, thank you very much for your time as ever. We will catch up with you again soon. Anything you want to leave? Any gambits you want to leave us with? Well, is the haircut booked? Can you get the haircut? What's the latest on that?
Well, I can't get it, so grew it as a bit until January 1st, and then we're in lockdown for at least another month. So I mean, it's staying.
I'm excited for it. I think it looks great.
You know, I might set up like a crowdfunder for getting myself some new hats, because I'm blowing out the seams on them with the volume of hair that's underneath them.
You're literally blowing your hats apart with your own hair. We need to get a video shoot scheduled quite soon, don't we? Just so that everyone at home can see it. But in the meantime, before we can get back to you next, please stay tuned to the Enduro World Series social media channels, as well as to our official media partners over at the Global Mountain Bike Network. They've got videos out every day with the latest tech and news from the world of mountain biking. If you have any specific ideas for episodes of this podcast or questions that you want to see tackled, please drop them into the comments on those socials, and we'll do our best to tackle them as and when we can. Ruairi, thank you very much, and see you next time.
Will do. Good to talk to you.